The following program is a production of KHNS. Its content does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Board of Directors and staff of Lynn Canal Broadcasting Incorporated, the licensee. Good morning. This is Lynn Canal Voice, a new public affairs show from the KHNS newsroom. I'm News Director Emily Files. Today we're talking about local issues around state and national parks. But before that discussion, let's take a look at recent and upcoming news in the Upper Lynn Canal. Reporter Abby Collins is here with me, and we're going to chat about some of the news this week. Hi, Abby.
Good morning.
So the big news this morning is that the Haynes Borough Assembly terminated Borough Manager Bill Seward's contract last night. It was time for his six-month performance evaluation, and he asked for it to be in public rather than in executive session. The assembly spent about 3.5 hours discussing Seward's job performance and what recourse to take, and all of the assembly members were pretty critical. They discussed giving him a chance to remedy some of the concerns with a 3-month probationary period, but ultimately the assembly voted 4-2 to terminate his contract with cause. Assembly members Tom Morfitt, Tresham Gregg, Ron Jackson, and Margaret Friednauer voted in favor of dismissing Seward. Heather Lendy and Mike Case voted against it. They didn't discuss who would take over as interim manager. In the past, Public Facilities Director Brad Ryan and Borough Clerk Julie Causey have filled that role. And we'll have a story about all that in tonight's local news. Abby, that's not the only news that came out of the two-night Haynes Assembly meeting this week. They also made a decision about the controversial Heliski map. So you covered those meetings. How many were there? Like five meetings?
So there were five after that initial meeting, five working meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Five meetings where a lot of work was done. It's a lot of work to go through those map areas, to review fish and game comments and backcountry user comments and neighbor comments. And this committee of five people did that five times throughout the last few months. And it may... That work may not actually influence the map ultimately is what we learned this week. Mm-hmm. At that Borough Assembly meeting, the first part of it on Tuesday.
Yes,
start on
Tuesday.
At the first part of that Borough Assembly meeting, former Borough Manager Bill Seward made his recommendations to the Assembly, which were based on the recommendations he received from that map committee. And his recommendations were... Basically, he recommended 10 areas for approval, all of which received unanimous consent from the map committee, and for the most part didn't really have significant concerns from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Mm-hmm.
There always seem to be possible concerns with wildlife in those areas, but for the most part, those were the areas that were of least concern for neighbors, for backcountry users, for the committee, and for Fish and Game.
And those wildlife concerns, that was a big part of why the Borough Assembly decided to delay any changes to the map committee. Can you talk about that?
Right. So right now, Fish and Game doesn't have the kind of concrete information they'd like to have to be commenting on these areas, because there's still two really significant studies in the works. One is a mountain goat study, which would give us more information about winter habitats for mountain goats. So they have actual mm-hmm. collars on these goats. They'll know where they are. They will know where they winter. And that'll be really concrete information about where we should and shouldn't be heliskiing.
And that's due to come out when?
Right now, it's the spring of 2017. So not too far off, but far enough off that they don't have that information.
And right so that now. Was one of the criticisms that people brought up during the Heliski Map Committee meetings, was that the study is somewhat close on the horizon, so why is the borough going to change the map before these come out? And potentially it might not be able to be changed for another 3 years, because that is in borough code. It's changes to the map every 3 years.
Right. So they could have technically been locked out for mm-hmm. the next 3 years, even if we learned that there was significant wildlife concerns in those areas. And then on top of that, they're working on a bear denning study that would just give more information about where bears are denning. And the concern there is that you could wake up get bears mm-hmm. out of their dens early.
Disturb the wildlife.
Disturb the wildlife, area. Yeah. So that's another one that is slated to come out in 2017, another one that would help form this map with more information. So the Assembly ultimately voted to postpone making those map changes until we had that information from those two fish and game studies. Mm-hmm. At that point, they'll form a new committee, which will go through this process again.
And that also, forming a new committee, Ron Jackson, the borough assembly member who made this motion, wanted to do it after the code around who actually sits on the committee is changed, which has been a topic of debate as well, because the two Heliski company representatives who submitted map change requests were also on the five-person committee, one of them as an industry representative and one of them in one of the general public seats. So that was another topic of controversy for this Heliski map process.
Right. That sort of overshadowed a lot of the work that they were doing throughout a lot of that process, because we had these two permit holders on the committee. And it ultimately led to two citizen appeals that were heard at the Borough Assembly meeting this week as well. Mm-hmm. One related to the Tourism Advisory Board that tied back into the Heliski Committee, and one directly related to the Heliski Committee. We've also seen several attorney opinions related to this at this point from the borough attorney, and how we are or are not following code in these circumstances.
Yeah, so it brought up a lot of questions.
A lot of questions.
Yeah, and so we're talking about the Haines Assembly. The Skagway Assembly has a meeting this week, and one of the big topics for that meeting is a state grant that the borough received for port improvements. And the port improvements in Skagway have been in limbo for the past year because of the rejection of a tidelands lease between the borough and White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad. And the borough has struggled on how to move forward after that lease rejection. Now they've hired a port consultant, a kind of third party outside perspective to help things move forward. But this borough assembly meeting, they're going to be talking about what to do with this state legislative grant, which is due to expire in June of 2017, so in about 6 months. And the borough manager has recommended that they ask for another 1 year extension, which they asked for last year after the lease vote and was approved. And it seems like the borough manager thinks that it will be approved again. So that is on this week's Skagway Borough Assembly agenda. That's tonight, Thursday at 7 p.m. Today is December 15th, and that means it's the last day for Haines State Trooper Andrew Neeson, and his position right now is not going to be filled because of budget cuts. So, Abby, you're going to cover a couple meetings about this topic next week.
Yes, right. So we learned last week that the Chilkat Valley is losing its only non-wildlife trooper today, I guess. That position won't be filled due to looming budget cuts. We won't know for a while if eventually it will come back. So Police Chief Heath Scott has set up these town hall meetings for next week. Next Tuesday, December 20th, one will be at the public library here, and one will be out at Mosquito Lake afterwards to sort of talk through what this means for the people of Haines. Particularly, mm-hmm. the people that will be most affected are those that live sort of out of city limits. So mm-hmm. Out the highway, out Lutac, out Mud Bay, those are where.
Right. So in those areas, Trooper Neeson has a kind of proactive patrol where he's driving around out the highway and out Mud Bay and Lutac and sort of monitoring the area for anything of concern. And what Police Chief Heath Scott said is the police department can respond to calls in outside of the town site. And the wildlife trooper can also respond to calls. But without this state trooper, there won't be a proactive law enforcement presence in these areas. So he said at the borough assembly meeting this week that that's something he wants to talk to the residents outside of the town site about, how much a proactive presence do they want out there, and how should the police department go about providing that if that is something that people want.
Right.
All right, so that's coming up next week. And I think that that's all the news that we're going to talk about for now. This is reporter Abby Collins in the studio with me. Thanks, Abby.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll get back to our main conversation about state and national parks issues. You're listening to Lynn Canal Voice, a new public affairs show from the KHNS News Team. It is 10:13. I'm Emily Files. Today we're talking about state parks issues in Haines and national parks issues in Skagway. Later in the hour, Ben Hayes from the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park in Skagway will join me. But right now we're going to turn to Haines State Parks Ranger Travis Russell and Alaska Chilkoot Bear Foundation President Pam Randles. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you and good morning.
Yeah,
good
thanks morning. For having us, Emily.
So Travis, could you start by just quickly describing what state parks are in this area and what your main responsibilities are?
The three main state parks here are Chilkoot Lake State Recreation Area. There's also Chilkat State Park on the southern end of the peninsula, and then there's the Bald Eagle Preserve. Between those three, stay pretty busy between managing tourists and bears in the summer to bald eagle viewers in the fall, and then skiing and winter recreation over the winter, as well as planning for the next season.
Mm-hmm. One of the biggest state parks issues in Haines is management of the Chilkoot Corridor, which gets really busy in the summer. Bears congregate there to feed on salmon, and the bears and salmon also bring fishermen and tourists and more to the area. So Parks has managed the campground out there for a while, and the park ranger does oversee some of the bear viewing happening there. But just this year, the Department of Transportation switched management of the road itself to Parks. So Travis, what are the plans to improve that area?
As most of the community knows, the long-term plan is for the bear viewing platforms, and that went through a process years before I got here, which has only been a year and a half or so. So now that Parks manages that road, we'll be implementing the plans to build in those bear viewing platforms along mm-hmm. with hopefully improvements to the road. The management of the bear and human interactions is ongoing. We've implemented having a bear monitor, as we had this summer, that was funded through the borough, as well as we have a permanent seasonal position that assists with that, but is not 100% dedicated to time out there, although it's a pretty high percentage of time. So as well as much of my time will be spent out there as well. So between the management of the road and the campground is almost a joint effort, because a lot of people are going through to recreate at the lake as well as the campground. Mm-hmm. So
you mentioned the bear monitor position. Pam, as someone who keeps an eye on the situation out there, did you see any improvements this summer with having that position back? I understand that it was here before, but then it was not filled for a while, or it was cut out of the state parks budget. And so now Haines found a way to fund that position. Did you see any improvements?
Oh, yeah, because there is a situation out there where there's very close proximity between bears and people, mm-hmm. as most listeners know. And a lot of our visitors have no idea how to behave around bears. And so to have somebody out there who can help them with that, and help them not do things that aggravate the bears, makes a huge, huge difference. And you can really tell the difference in years when there's a monitor and when there isn't.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that there could be any improvements on how it went this past summer? Did it seem like there were still problems with the human-bear interaction?
There were some. And part of the issue is, there's going to be some, as Travis mentioned, there's going to be some platforms put in. Hopefully that will gather people in predictable places. Because if people are predictable, then bears are less of an issue because they know what we're doing and, you know, all that stuff. And then there will also be monitor positions out there. We'll still have volunteers out there to try and help people use the platforms and not do things that aggravate bears, whether it's in ignorance or otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I have hopes that things will continue to get better.
Mm-hmm. So is this bear monitor position a long-term thing?
I hope so. As far as with the borough funded, it was for 2 years, so we'll have it through this next summer. Whether that continues or not is unknown, depending on state budget. I did just submit a hiring waiver for the permanent seasonal tech position that serves as a bear monitor out there as well, and that was just submitted this past week. So we're hoping to continue that. And as I'm learning in my 2 seasons here, I need to change some of my practices as well, and one of the many things is just alternating when my work week is, as well as the time spent out there being offset from those, so we can maximize our staff time coverage out there. Because the biggest need out there is just a proactive approach to public information, and people who are nothing against them, but they are ignorant of it just simply because they're not from the area. And speaking to an Australian park ranger who visited 2 years ago, they have the same issues where he worked with kangaroos. So it's so it was an interesting perspective speaking to him.
People want to get that picture of the bears in Alaska.
Yeah, just like they want on the kangaroos in Australia, and they don't know. They're just not understanding how dangerous that situation may be.
Right, because there's no protection. There's no barrier in between where the people are standing and where the bears are feeding on salmon.
Well, and also, a lot of people who don't live in bear country, or for that matter, kangaroo country, don't really often see those bears as something real. Because they've seen TV bears and all this sort of stuff, and they either see Bart the Bear growling at everybody, or they see these cute little teddy bears that were taken with photos of camera lenses a mile long that were far enough away, and the bears don't look at them, and so a lot of people think the bears don't see them, which isn't true, because when bears look at you, it's too late. that's a threatening thing to do, and when we look at them, that's threatening as well. And so people see them walking along and think, oh, there's no problem. But there is. You know, they need to keep their distance and watch body language and that sort of thing. And so it's, as Travis was saying, it's a matter of educating people and coaching them. And then 99% of them are fine once they know what to do.
So, Travis, you you kind of referred to this, but you were talking about adjusting your hours to make sure there was more coverage out there. One thing I did hear from some LUTAC residents is that even though there was a bear monitor position this summer, it didn't cover all of the hours that need coverage, because people will go to the river to take pictures late at night, early in the morning, and maybe the bear monitor is only there from 9 to 5 or for part of the day. So what was the coverage like this past summer? How many what hours was there a bear monitor out there, and are you hoping to change that next summer?
The hours were basically 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. We tried to mix it up a little. Problem is, we only had one vehicle between two of them. Learning from that, what I'd like to see next year is starting at about 7 a.m., which is right at the tail end of the morning time that they're feeding out there, and have the bear monitors working that shift, and then I would take a later shift that would run till 6 or 7 in the evening, or right up until it's dark and they're out of there. So, yeah, there's a lot of improvement that needs to happen as far as that goes, and that's just tweaking the schedule a little bit and managing that. One of the challenges was bringing people on mid-season and hiring new employees and just getting them started. And so it's just getting a little earlier start on that next year, as well as just making that break of between the schedules early on. So I'm hoping to have it of coverage sometime between basically between the morning and evening feeding hours mm-hmm. around that time.
So. Pam, do you think that was the main shortcoming this past summer, is just not having enough hours of bear monitor coverage?
That was part of it. And then, as Travis said, there were two new people who hadn't done it before. And we have discussed about changing the training a little bit so that they get a little bit more experience before they're on their own. Mm-hmm. And so I think those modifications can be made. But generally, it's true because, I mean, the bears live out there 24/7. And people, because of long daylight, want to fish and want to see them, and they come out to see them. And so there's a long day there. And it's hard to cover that. It's hard to, you know, unless you've got ultimate staff money,
right?
You know.
Unless you've got funds to cover a 24-hour shift.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
You know.
That does seem like a hard job because it's difficult to approach strangers and say, you know, you're doing something wrong or, you know, handle kind of a chaotic situation out there. So what kind of training are you looking into?
Basically, Pam and I worked on some curriculum this past spring where we spoke to, it's similar to what the guide training was for all the commercial outfitters. So we go through different types of bear behavior, what's the appropriate response to that. I think one of the things we'll work on is also how to speak to people as well. I mean, that's just any job, it seems like. It's just learning to communicate tactfully with people. And so I think that's going to be something we'll incorporate in the future. And a lot of the training that we came up with, and mostly Pam, she's the teacher who came up with a lot of the curriculum, a lot of it was scenario-based. And I think a lot of those scenarios were very realistic. In fact, all of them were pulled from situations.
Yeah, they were all real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's, I think as we learn and as I learn from season to season, there's things that we can apply to that training. But yeah, it's just basic bear behavior and then just basic interaction with people and then also communication within internally within parks locally as mm-hmm. to how to get the response we need.
I think there's one other thing too. It's all very well to show videos and act out scenarios and all the rest of it, but then to send somebody out there and there's a great big 500-pound bear standing there, that's a little bit of a reality check. Mm-hmm. And so I would like to see, and you know, I'm not speaking for Travis because I don't know how he feels about this, but I would like to see the bear monitor staff people go out with somebody and actually see on the ground with a real bear instead of just a scenario. And the thing is, if you train really early in the season and the bears aren't there, that's hard to do. And so hopefully we can work that in a little bit more so that they can actually realistically see what it's like when you see a large, long-toothed, long-clawed animal like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And one thing to add to that that Pam reminded me of is that as far as scheduling, we're also going to push the season back as far as the start date because the bears typically aren't there in June. And the ones that are, we can handle with the staff that we have until the other ones come on. So
This past summer they started in June and then ended in August?
August. And then one of them ended in August, and I want to say the other one mid-September. Mm-hmm. So a little before the end of the bear viewing season. So,
do you have any kind of process for gathering feedback from I guess all the stakeholders, people who live out there, tour operators, fishermen, or are you just kind of piecing together what you've heard from people?
It's all piecing together public opinion. We don't have any formal park surveys. Probably the closest that we'd have had to that would be some sort of public meeting. I guess mm-hmm. it would be Chilcat Bald Eagle Council is one meeting that's about the most
formal.
General. It is formal, but it's the most general in addressing issues. But most of it's just, it's hearsay, it's suggestions, trial by public opinion, you know, all of the
which above. I think it might be difficult because you might hear from one person who has a very strong opinion, but maybe they're not representative of the general view.
And I do see that a lot, and I come across that daily where people have very strong opinions about different aspects of the management out there. And it's balancing with a listening ear as well as possibly education or redirection if the situation calls for it. But there is nothing formal at the moment.
We try, we meaning the Bear Foundation, we try to serve in that capacity whenever we can. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't answer his phone at his office, you know, so mm-hmm. we don't hear everything, but we do try to keep track of people as much as we can and let Travis know when we're hearing stuff.
Mm-hmm. So before I let Pam go, I wanted to talk about the gate at the Chilkoot Corridor. That's something that we've done a couple stories about recently, but it's quite a big concern for some people, so I want to address it again. So Parks recently installed a gate on the Chilkoot Road a bit before Deer Rock. So Pam, you've expressed concern about the gate. Have the answers that you've heard met your concerns, or do you still have some worries about that?
I still have a few concerns. I mean, when I first went out and looked at it, my first thought was, yeah, that's a parks gate. That's what parks do. They put gates up. On the other hand, there's already a gate at the campground.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally understand the reason for that one, because it needs to close when either there's bears in the area or for wintertime when there's no supervision out there. I still have some questions about the reason this gate was installed or the reason it was felt to be necessary. And that's a Juno question. That's not anybody here who really knows, other than we were told it was for safety. My question about the safety part of it is the same issues have been all along, and if there was an incident out there, you could just park your car sideways and that would block the whole road. So, mm-hmm. But again, I also know that almost every park I've ever been to has had gates. So I'm sort of in the middle.
Right. Travis?
All right. Well, I'm glad we walked that elephant into the room.
knew it was coming.
Yes. And I actually spoke by telephone with the Planning Commission this past week. Mm-hmm. So to kind of reiterate what I said in that, as well as expand on it as knowledge has come forth over this past week. The purpose of the gate, well, it goes back to State Parks has now taken over management of the road. And so my management has advised me that the gate is a management tool, so we can close that gate if there ever were an emergency. As far as what may constitute an emergency out there, I don't know. We'll just have to find out as that comes along. The one positive aspect of the gate as a management tool is that it does help us in terms of having accurate counts of visitors. And right now we don't have it installed, but as part of the plan for the gate, between the two signs, the large signpost out there with the black and yellow diamond placards on them, is room for an entrance station, and that'll be a place where hopefully we can have staff there that will be able to distribute material and speak to visitors as they're coming into the corridor about appropriate bear behavior. It'll also allow us to keep an accurate count of how many visitors are coming and going, and both between commercial as well as private, because commercial bicyclists don't always register on our pneumatic road counters. Pam?
I was just going to say that the idea of having a staffed kiosk is something that the Bear Foundation has argued for, mostly to get information to people so that they get the information before they're running all over the road with bears all over the road and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for information purposes, that would be great. My only question on that one, and this is a question nobody can answer right now, is where's the money going to come from to pay for the staff? We keep hearing about budget cuts and it's difficult to get monitors in there. And so, you know, I just don't. But I would love to see some staff out there to be informing folks of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So I realize that Park says this is something they do for all of the facilities they own, and they're not planning on closing the gate except in some extreme emergency. But what about the other questions, like the fact that this is a culturally significant area? It limits parking, which is already limited, and it could restrict access to privately owned areas.
I have heard all of those concerns. So beginning with the culturally sensitive area, I know that came up as well in the Planning Commission meeting and some of the documents they had asked for. when our engineers are on site, the reason we have an engineer while a contractor is working is to make sure that, for one, they're abiding by the terms of the contract and they're installing it to the standard by which the plans call for. The other purpose of having them there is, in really culturally sensitive areas, are to make sure if anything were to be turned up, they would stop work immediately and contact the appropriate sources to deal with that, and that would be the Office of History and Archaeology. I know Troopers had a case a few years ago out in Western Alaska, and so it's treated, I mean, you have four different agencies working on those, so that's something that is addressed in the plans, and I know that is a concern out there because it is a very culturally sensitive area and culturally rich in a lot of ways. So that's one concern. Trying to think of what the other concerns were as far as
limited parking and also limiting access to privately owned areas.
Okay, and I'll go into the privately owned because that was also brought up during the Planning Commission meeting. I have spoken to Chilkat Indian Association, and currently they don't have anybody living out at the culture camp. So as far as access goes, I'll tell you right now, the pins are too short to lock the gate, so we can't even lock it until we get new pins.
Really?
But the point is, we don't foresee closing that where it would prevent anybody accessing private property or using the lake to access the private property across that. So there's nothing that I've been told that would limit that. The other problem that I keep bringing up is we do have a campground at the end of that road. And when people pay for that campground, we can't restrict them in their coming and going from that. It's just like trying to lock somebody out of a hotel room. You can't really do that. So the idea of locking it, if it were to happen in an emergency, I can't really speculate on what it would constitute, but it would be very temporary and for a very limited time only to address that emergency before it would be open. And then as far as parking goes, where the gate is, that took out basically two parking spaces. The bear viewing platforms will also limit parking to the opposite side of the road, so parking will become limited. There's nothing I'm aware of that will expand that parking. It's just going to be, we're going to have to be very proactive on traffic management out there. Mm-hmm. So
we're going to move on to other state parks issues, but before we do, Pam, I want to get your final thoughts on Chilkoot.
Well, it's sort of an ongoing thing and an ongoing negotiation, and we're trying, I think all parties involved are trying our best to make this the best possibility for fishermen, viewers, campers in the campsite, and all the rest of it. And it's just been a long struggle, and we'll just keep on struggling until we get it right. That's all I can say.
Do you feel like things are looking positive?
I do, actually, because, I mean, among other things, the money for the infrastructure thing I think will help. My experience with parks areas has been that when you build structures, people use them because they see them as that's what they're for. Instead of being everywhere, it helps people stay in predictable places. And that's really important where wildlife is concerned, is for us as humans to be very, very predictable. So I have hopes for the platforms. On the other hand, we need to see how big they're going to be and how intrusive they're going to be or not. The plans don't look terribly intrusive to me. They look like they're going to work, the platform proposals. However, having said that, I'm going by what was decided in the public hearings and what is now online as the plan, and I know that that has been changed. So I'm still kind of hedging my bets until I see what the final thing is.
By the way, when will we see that final product? When is the work going to happen?
I just asked about that yesterday during our staff teleconference. So right now, our design and construction staff are in the process of coming with the finalizations of the minute details of that plan. So I don't have an exact time frame. I would anticipate sometime this spring, and then it has to go out to bid. And then once that's settled, then the contractor will take over from there. So.
I hope so. This has been going on for a number of years. It's not Travis's fault, but it's been going on for a number of years, and we need to go forward. The money has been allocated. Excuse me. The money has been allocated. It's there, and we need to use it.
Mm-hmm. Pam Randles, president of the Chilkoot Bear Foundation, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pam.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk a little bit more with Travis Russell. Good morning. You're listening to Lynn Canal Voice on KHNS. I'm Emily Files here with Haines State Parks Ranger Travis Russell. All right, Travis, we only have about five more minutes before we turn to Skagway, but let's talk about Chilkat State Park. I hear that you're hoping to improve the Seduction Point Trail there. What are your plans?
We put in for a grant. It's the same type of recreational trails grant that we put in for Battery Point. And so what we are planning on in this first phase is just repairing some of the infrastructure down to the Moose Meadows section of trail. And that includes replacing bridges as well as installing some turnpike where necessary. It's not going to be the same grade of trail as Battery Point will be, but it's just simple improvements to make it less hazardous as well as mitigate some of the environmental damage from heavy foot traffic.
So did you say you applied for that grant?
We did. And as far as those grants go, we don't find out until usually late April if we receive the grant or not.
So is it just the first portion of the trail to Moose Meadows that you're hoping to work on?
That's correct.
Okay. So why is that something that is a focus for you?
It's because that area is seeing increased use, and that is the most highly used part of the trail. So now that we've finished up with Battery Point, then we're looking to just improve infrastructure that has not been addressed recently. So.
Yeah, I really like that trail, so that'll be great to see some improvements there if the grant does come through.
Yeah, it's a very nice, easy rolling trail with not a whole lot of elevation, so it's actually pretty easy.
And the view at the end of the Moose Meadows part of it is just spectacular.
Yeah, I always enjoy walking through the part with the moss just beyond Moose Meadows. It reminds me of my time when I worked out at Kodiak, just very similar to Shuyak Island in terms of the ground cover. So.
And you have a view of the Davidson and Rainbow Glaciers there.
Yeah, and the Chilkat Cabin's pretty awesome views as well. I enjoy working out of that.
So any other trail improvements on the horizon?
No, that's the only one we're working on. We have pretty limited trail staff. I have Dallas, my trails tech, Dallas Anderson. He's a really knowledgeable trails guy. And then I had Liz Seegers as our ACC on trails. And the two of them did a great job this summer finishing up Battery Point and the small extension to the start of the Mount Riley Trail. But having only two people there, you're pretty limited to the amount of work that you can cover in one season. So,
did Battery Point see more traffic this summer because of those trail improvements? What have you heard?
I would say so. Our traffic counter's not working at the moment. I've been playing around with that, but it's but we're seeing pretty high traffic on it. When I did have a game camera set up to verify those numbers, we were seeing numbers that were congruent with what it was showing on the trail counter. So it seems to go up quite a bit during that summer season. So,
mm-hmm. All right, Travis, is there anything else you want to talk about regarding state parks in Haines?
Oh, not much. I guess with snow, it's time to go groom trails. So track is now set out along Chilkoot as well as Chilkat. It's going to be a pretty icy slide down the Chilkat Hill, so be careful out there. But it's beautiful views, like you said.
Mm-hmm. So. Parks Ranger Travis Russell, thanks for taking the time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is Lynn Canal Voice. We're going to take a quick break and then turn to Skagway. Thank you. It is 10:42. You're listening to Lynn Canal Voice on KHNS. I'm Emily Files, and we are turning now to Skagway and the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. And I think that we have Ben Hayes in our studio in Skagway. Ben, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me.
Wow, it's working. Okay, great. Hi, Ben. Ben is the park's chief of interpretation. He's in the KHNS Skagway studio, which I am so happy is working.
Yeah.
All right,
we got it. We got it going on.
Great. So the park is in full swing during the summer, but now that it's winter, what kind of things are you working on there?
Well, we just opened new museum exhibits this month and had our grand opening on the 2nd of December, and we've been really pleased with that. We are finishing that project throughout the winter and spring, including the installation of audio description tours for people with visual impairments so they can experience the exhibits as well. We also have a ton of goods display with a sculpture of a stampeder that is going to be installed on just across the street from our visitor center on Broadway. We're looking forward to getting that completed. And we have new Dyee town site trails that are almost complete, so you can have a different experience if you visit the Dyee town site. The new trail system actually is on the old road grid of the town site, so it gives you a better sense of what the town looked like as you walk around in that area. And new wayside exhibits are going up in that area. We also have new wayside exhibits that are going to be installed later this year along the Chilkoot Trail. If anyone's hiked the trail, they might have noticed the wayside exhibits that kind of tell you about some of the places along the way, and points of interest have been, you know, older, in need of repair. And so those are already at our sheep camp ranger cabin and going to be installed this summer. So that's coming up. And we also, one of my favorite projects we're working on now are the creation of virtual tours for 11 of our park buildings. So people who may never have the opportunity to visit Skagway can explore some of our very painstakingly restored and maintained historic Gold Rush era buildings. And it's going to be a really unique experience when that's complete.
When are those going online?
We hope to have those completed before May.
Yeah, so those are kind of digital tours. You can go and take a tour of Soapy Smith's parlor or one of the other museums there. I got a little preview of it, and it looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it does. It's using new software developed for actually the real estate industry, and it gives both the kind of Google Street View experience inside the
building.
That's
a good way to describe it.
Yeah, as well as it also did a 3D scan of the environment, so it produces a dollhouse effect, so you can manipulate the building and look around from, you know, looking at it from outside like you would a dollhouse with just, you know, the floors and the room interiors exposed. It's a really very interactive and interesting way to explore on your computer.
So you're not worried that people are going to go on the computer and take a free digital tour of one of the museums and then not actually pay for the tour?
No, not at all. I think this will only pique your appetite to actually see some of the artifacts and exhibits. And first of all, our museum is and will always be free, as well as like the Mascot Saloon and the Morehouse. And we'll have many opportunities to explore Jeff Smith's parlor for free, just like we did last year. And if you want a really incredible tour, we have that available again for $5 during the summer.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking about bear issues at Chilkoot State Park in Haines, and there were some bear problems this summer in Skagway as well. First of all, two bears were shot on the Chilkoot Trail because they displayed food-conditioned behavior, which is dangerous for an area with so many hikers. So, Ben, that was a really unprecedented event in the recent history of the Chilkoot Trail. What is the Klondike Park and Parks Canada doing to try to prevent something like this happening again?
Well, yeah, it was unprecedented that that bears or a bear broke into the ranger cabin at Lindman City in Canada. And that did cause in June a closure of the Chilkoot Trail, which for bears, which is also not precedented, and ultimately it resulted in the putting down of two bears. And then we had our own incident in our Dyea campground later this summer, and that resulted in a bear being put down.
So that was let me give a little bit of background on that. That was an incident this summer when a Skagway police officer accidentally shot a bear with a lethal slug instead of hazing it with a rubber bullet. I guess what those two incidents have in common is that they both had to do with food-conditioned bears, and the Skagway one, had to do with a lack of training. But, yeah, talk about what you guys are working on to try to prevent another summer of bear problems.
Well, we have had a number of positive outcomes from last summer, and the most important is the enhanced relationships that we have with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the Skagway Police Department, in addition to Parks Canada, which has always been an ongoing and strong relationship. And we have, as a result, more cooperation, ongoing training and planning and routine meetings so that we are constantly working on this issue. And I guess the takeaway for me and kind of my duties are to amp up our education and awareness of, bears. You know, the basic takeaway, is it a fed bear? Is it a dead bear? And we, have these communities right in the middle of bear country. We're in their living environment, and we have, a huge increase of visitors in the summer that are on the South Klondike Highway, and we've had anecdotal reports that bears are being fed there, and that's may lead to bears becoming habituated and food conditioned and associating people and human structures with food sources and becoming losing their natural fear of people. And that's what we want to continue to make abundantly clear and have some more training and public awareness programs in the, particularly in April and in May, when we have our new folks coming in to not only visit and recreate here, but also to work here. And so that's a major goal this year or this next year.
So what education or programs are you planning that haven't happened before with the visitors, seasonal workers, that kind of thing?
Well, we routinely train our seasonal workforce in the park on bear behavior, bear biology, and bear safety. And so we hope to open those opportunities up to the public and encourage anyone that we work with that provide tour opportunities to visitors to join that training and be given some really good understanding of why bears do what they do, and what we can do as people to prevent bears from associating humans and human structures with food, and then some preventative measures that you can do when we camp or when we when we live in the bear country, and protecting anything that smells, securing all food, and just keeping those opportunities for bears from happening to begin with. But it'll be several opportunities for people to engage in some training along with our very trained staff here.
Is this a mandatory training?
It is mandatory for our staff. It will be strongly encouraged for members of the public who are interested, and our partners, we'll invite our partners and those who work with us for tours within the park area, will definitely encourage. I don't think it'll necessarily be mandatory.
For tour guides or?
Right, yeah. No. I don't think we have the ability to do that, nor would we want to make anything necessarily mandatory if we can avoid that.
So you said you're going to be encouraging training. Is there anything else that you're kind of going beyond what you've done in the past because of these recent bear problems?
I think, again, the main takeaway from this for us is the enhanced relationships we have, and that we'll have ongoing training with our partners, Parks Canada, the Skagway Police Department, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We had a very positive and great, terrific training in September 30th and that's something that included mostly bear hazing techniques, and that's something we only would like law enforcement to do. No one should be hazing bears unless you're very thoroughly trained, and that's not something that the average person or tour guide or would want to do, just to be safe on how to take yourself out of an aggressive bear, not to haze. So hazing is for people that are trained to do. That's something we want to stress.
So this training in September was with the Skagway Police Department?
Right, yeah, the Skagway Police Department, our law enforcement and trail rangers, and a biologist, our biologist here in Skagway in the park, and the biologist from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game were all part of that training.
And you mentioned when we talked before this conversation that you're working on a bear management plan. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we completed a thorough update to our bear management plan for our park, which really emphasizes a lot of the things that we've discussed this morning, in particular the training and education, and the working with the Skagway Bear Group, which includes the Skagway Police Department and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game as specified partners, in which we meet and we have plans in case incidents occur. And, you know, we're really emphasizing the prevention and education awareness aspect as well.
So that is a plan that the park came up with, or was that in conjunction with Fish and Game and the police department or any other agencies?
The plan was for the park. So we have a really structured program on how to work with our partners and in the park. It really specifies what all of our employees need to do for each type of incident, the responsibilities for who does what in terms of responding to an incident, and it really sets in motion a rejuvenation of the Skagway Bear Group, and that's something that we're really excited about. And as a takeaway from the events this year, again, that's all about enhancing working relationships and working with our partners.
The Skagway Bear Group, could you tell me more about that?
Right. Well, the Skagway Bear Group is with us, and it includes some of the park folks like our law enforcement rangers and our natural resource program manager, our biologist, and the Skagway Police Department, and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are all part of the bear working group. And so we met throughout the summer, particularly following the incident in Dai, and we plan to meet more. Tentatively, we'd like to have a meeting in March, which, you know, bears come out in the spring and they're out there, and then they are very visible in the fall. And so those are the key times of year they want to be prepared for. And the group existed before the incidents this summer, but now it's enhanced, it rejuvenated, and with the a really good working relationship moving forward.
So do you think enhanced training is going to be enough to prevent these kind of situations?
I think that's part of it. And the sense of training isn't just, okay, we did a training once and now we're done training forever. It's ongoing. It's continual. And that includes meeting and preparing and discussing. And, you know, we could have all the training we ever want. But if we have people feeding bears, then that training doesn't solve that. It's education and awareness that is very critical to making sure that we don't have any situations where we're putting down bears every summer.
Is there anything else that you want to add?
I just want to invite everyone in the Lynn Canal to visit the park this year. In 2017, there's a lot of new things coming and a lot of new things that are ready to experience.
That's Ben Hayes, Chief of Interpretation for Skagway's Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. Thanks so much, Ben, and I'm glad things worked out at the Skagway studio.
Yes, thank you so much. Pleasure.
All right, talk to you later. And that's it for Lynn Canal Voice. I'm Emily Files. Thanks for joining me this hour. Thanks to Rebecca Hilton, Janine Allen, and Abby Collins for production help. If you have suggestions for topics or guests to have on the show, let me know. You can reach me at news@khns.org. And if you missed any of today's program, we'll post the audio at our website, khns.org. Lynn Canal Voice will be back in January. This is KHNS, Haines, Skagway, and Klukwan.